Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Joe Brockmeyer joins me. We're going to talk about OSCON, my favorite big show that I try to get to every year. We're going to be chatting with Simon St. Laurent about the whole thing. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Joe Brockmeyer. Episode 292, recorded May 1st, 2014. OSCON. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre open source software. I'm your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneAge.com, bringing you each week, or as often as I can do it, the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and not be aware of it, projects you may never heard of but now want to go play with it. I get a lot of those on the show a lot, so I like finding out about stuff myself. Joining me again this week is my co-host. Joining me this week again is Joe Brockmeyer, also known as Zonker. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be on this morning.
Apparently, they let anybody do this show because I get so tongue-tied sometimes trying to get the show up and running and everything like that. And where are you speaking to us from?
Home in St. Louis this week.
St. Louis. Okay. And I'm, as people can recognize, I got the nice big tree behind me. That's, of course, ZipRecruiter, currently paying my bills. So they've given me, of course, the bandwidth and office space to be able to use to host this show. This week, we have a very special show. That's why we're on a very special time. We got preempted yesterday for those that tried to tune in yesterday for Floss Weekly or tried to find us in their stream yesterday. It's because we got preempted, moved down one day. So it's a special taping time because we have a very special show. We're going to talk about OSCON, the open source conference. It's been running for, geez, I think like 15 years now. It's been a while. And we have a very special guest also on the show to talk about OSCON, and that's Simon St. Laurent. I've known him for many years. He's an O'Reilly employee and has been basically, he's the co-chair this year for OSCON. We'll bring him on in a second, but you've been to OSCON before, right, Joe?
Yeah, I've been probably since 2006. I've only missed one year, I think.
Yeah, actually, I think I missed 2 years, which is sort of bizarre. I was out on my way to a conference in Australia, and in fact, that year was the year that I did my very first Floss Weekly. Where I interviewed, he's going to get mad at me for not remembering his name now, but somebody about Postgres. It'll come to me later, I guess. I'm going to look it up, too. And so I was actually in Hawaii interviewing him about Postgres it was the day before OSCON, so sort of an interesting, fun run there. And I also missed OSCON once because I was on a cruise ship that year, and cruises always take precedence over any important conference like OSCON. Anyway, OSCON's great, but rather than us chatting about it, let's go ahead and bring on an expert. Simon, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Great to be here.
Great. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm outside of Ithaca, New York. My roosters have decided to come hang out near my microphone, but... Yes, I'm kind of out in the woods here.
Well, I can't hear them yet, so hopefully they won't cut in too much. Of course, I'm really familiar with OSCON, but let's hear it from you. How did OSCON get started, and what does it mean to all of us?
Well, OSCON got started. Its roots are really in the Perl Conference, the Perl Conference, the Python Conference. We were bringing these groups together, and at just about the same time, the open source movement was getting started, the notion that there was a set of open source and compatible licenses that we could use to share a lot of ideas and projects around. So it evolved pretty quickly into the open source conference. It started in California. It's sort of bounced between California and Oregon. It's found a very happy home in Portland. This will be the 16th year, and will be July 20 to 24 in the Oregon Convention Center.
Well, and that's something I wanted to ask right away. Why Sunday through Thursday instead of the traditional Monday through Friday?
I wish I knew. I'm the program co-chair, not the scheduling co-chair. We'll see how it all goes. I suspect it's a 1 year change, but yes, there may be people coming in to study at the Church of Software.
Okay, that might work well, too. And I really appreciate that you have it in Portland, although given that I'm working mostly in Southern California these days, I actually have to schedule a trip home to Portland to actually come to OSCON every year, so it's a little weird.
It used to be a lot more convenient for you, yes.
Yes, yes. It's well, actually, it was in Silicon Valley a bunch, and oh, I guess it's been all over the place. It's been in Monterey. It's been in San Jose.
San Diego for a while.
San Diego, right? Yeah, that was great. We had some good times there, definitely. That would be a lot more convenient. Remember the couple of San Diego years. So, for those of us who aren't familiar with what happens at OSCON, or maybe even in conferences in general, why don't you give us the big picture about that?
Sure thing. So OSCON is what I think of as kind of a traditionally structured conference, in that it has 2 days of workshops, which are longer sessions with a lot of more hands-on, you know, here's how to learn this particular technology, or here's how to approach this set of problems. And then we have 3 days of, I guess I'd say, well, it's all kind of choose your own adventure, because, you know, you sign up for the conference and you can pick which tutorials, which sessions. It's a mix of keynotes, which are, I guess I'm thinking of them as kind of technical provocations, things to get you thinking differently, harder, or otherwise pushed in your technical thoughts. And then sessions, we have, at any given time, we have about 18 different sessions to choose from. They're sort of loosely tracked. You can stay in one room and basically follow Perl or follow the web. It's a lot of different options, a lot of different choices, a huge number of speakers. The conversations go on into the night. We have Birds of a Feather sessions. We'll have the State of the Onion with Larry Wall talking about Perl. The Perl Lightning tracks are also a part of that at night. There's an expo hall if you want to find vendors, if you want to find nonprofits, if you want to talk to O'Reilly. We have a whole a giant space of many open source conversations and possibilities. And we also have something called Office Hours, which is a fairly new addition, where if you have questions for speakers that you'd like to address in kind of a smaller group, you can come to these tables and talk with the speaker for, you know, half an hour. Sometimes it's been as many as 20 people, but more typically it's like five. I've had some great conversations in those.
So OSCON's been going on for 16 years, you said. So that I was actually pretty close to the 15 then.
Yes.
So what's been the biggest change in OSCON over the years?
It's when it first started, it was a group of separate conferences sort of all put together under the same roof. When I first started at O'Reilly, I was actually working on a piece of OSCON called X-Tech, which was a separate conference name that we'd wrapped into OSCON. Those were the days when XML was exciting, and I think that was when I met you on the XML Geek Cruise, actually. Uh-huh. So we have been on a cruise ship together. Mm-hmm. Over time, it's shifted. So some communities have... Some communities have come and gone, which is kind of strange and sad, but others have held on. It's become less of a, you know, this is the set of projects that are strictly Perl, and more of a, these are the problems that we're going to solve. This room is Perl, this room is Python, this room is web. But it's really kind of it's still a cross-section, but it's a more blended cross-section. One thing I'm happy to see is a fair number of talks that really explicitly cross boundaries. They're mixing different technologies, trying to figure out which things are the best for solving particular problems. And I guess the other thing that makes me happy about the way things have shifted is this blending and mixing makes it more exciting to cross those lines. One of the conversations I've had with people a few times about OSCON is that when they went to tracks that were strictly on the stuff that they did every day, it was useful content, but it wasn't like that exciting, driving them to new places. But when they stepped out of their own set of rooms, out of their own expectations, they found stuff that really, you know, pushed them to say, okay, that's how they do that in Clojure. How can I do that in the work I'm doing here in Ruby? Watching people apply like different messaging approaches in one room and then going to a project that's, you know, about the web, listening to that kind of conversation. So, you know, I think we've done what we can to make the cross-pollination happen a lot more regularly. There's more to do with that. I also kind of want to find some spaces where, you know, communities can tell their own stories. The State of the Onion in the gives Pearl kind of an explicit space for that, but I think we need to do more of that.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I really enjoy about OSCON is that there's, you know, we're all under the one big tent, and so it's really nice. I deliberately don't go to very many Pearl talks when I go to OSCON. I deliberately try to seek out other languages, other things I might be interested in, and it's worked really well for me. I try to attend as many of the BOFs as I can, although they tend to conflict with the party, so I'd say you have to choose one or the other. I prefer the social issues. And that's the other thing, too. I don't think you've mentioned this yet, but the hallway track, just the fact that you can bump into people all the way around and have these great conversations, and how you have these tables provided where people can sit and chat, mostly while they're online checking their email and stuff. But I found some really great conversations have happened at those tables as well.
Yeah, and we're actually going to try to expand those options this year. One thing, I love the hallway track. One of the things I was really happy about with our Fluent conference this year is that it developed a much more vibrant hallway track than it had in the past. Somehow we moved to a different venue and the space like facilitated conversation. And, you know, at OSCON we have tables, we have couches. I feel like a lot of the hallway conversation does actually happen in the expo hall, I think because it brings people to food. And we have tribe tables, for instance, where you can find people with similar interests. We're also doing a few things that encourage people to stick around with OSCON. We're going to have a refresh area where people can kind of chill out for a while, you know, rather than go back to their hotel room. They can find a quiet space and just kind of relax a bit and then come back into the conference. Hopefully having that kind of space will make it easier for more people to, you know, feel energized and ready to have those conversations.
All right. I've noticed, so I started going to OSCON, I think it was in 2006, and I've sort of noticed that to me, the audience seems to have changed, and it's become a much more commercial event. How do you think the audience has evolved over the years, and mm-hmm. the approach to OSCON by people who are sponsoring it?
The audience definitely has changed. It's still there's a core group of people. There are people who come to OSCON every year. There are people who've been coming to OSCON from the beginning. It's kind of fun talking with some of them and tracking how their interests have changed, but they still fit into OSCON. At the same time, OSCON's become a place where a lot of companies come to figure out what is this strange open source stuff? Are there ways we can apply it inside our organization, to our organization, and beyond our organization? I've had a lot of conversations at OSCON where somebody finds out I'm from O'Reilly, and they expect me to understand and be able to tell the full story of, you know, how you take an enterprise internal project and make it into a full-on open source project with a vibrant community. I can't always tell those stories quite the way that I would like for their particular challenges, but it's just been a regular feature of the conversation. And the other thing, open source is both a set of technologies and a set of practices. So there is a good chunk of the audience that just comes because they want to become better Python programmers, or they want to figure out how to connect the functional programming stack that's available on the JVM to their existing Java code. But there are also a bunch of people who are there to figure out, okay, I'm trying to figure out how to break my code out of this, you know, very closed, typically waterfall model and bring it to a wider group of people who I hope will be able to help me make it better. And that thread is a lot of the hallway track. It's a lot of the underlying assumptions of talks. And, you know, it's a lot of what I hear at lunch in particular. So yes, it has become a more enterprise, more corporate audience of attendees. The part of that makes me really happy, though, is that they seem to be there to figure out, you know, what is this stuff and how can I make it? How can I make it work for me?
So I'm kind of curious. I have the I often have the conversations with startups and with enterprise folks, and part of what I do for a living is actually trying to make upstreams and projects more successful. And I find when I have those conversations, often what you tell them, then you tell them what you think they need to do to make a successful open source project, and they sort of ignore what you're telling them. Do you kind of run into that? What do you tell people when you give them advice on how to make an enterprise open source project successful?
Well, part of what I tell them is that it's going to be different in every case. So, you know, I'm not really surprised if they do something different than I suggest. That sometimes it's just because they should have listened to me, but other times it's because I didn't, you know, have enough of the story, or they didn't tell me enough of the story.
Sure.
One of the things I keep finding is that organizations are trying to figure out how to apply these models inside their organization. So it's not that they're going to apply open source licenses to things, but that they want to start using tools like, you know, Git and GitHub and sort of the social model of developing software, a flatter model, I guess, rather than a hierarchical model. And I can kind of tell them that story, but I also need to add a bunch of warning labels about cultural shifts and the way that people who are used to being in control of a project are probably going to find themselves feeling less in control. And sometimes that's where the ignoring what I suggest comes from. Sometimes, though, that giving them that warning label at least gets them set up so that when they hit that kind of culture shock moment, they know what's going on. I'd like to find more ways to tell that kind of, we started, these are the barriers that we hit, kinds of stories, and help the people who are trying to break down those barriers, you know, tell each other their stories. I'm kind of a visible center point. I hear a lot, I see a lot, but it's actually the people who are doing the work inside those organizations who are probably better equipped to help each other out.
So I often feel like it's when someone comes up and asks you, you know, how do I lose weight without exercise
Yes.
or changing my diet? One question for you. So this year coming to OSCON will be, you know, we mentioned how the audience is changing. There will be a lot of folks going to OSCON for the first time, just as well as a lot of people returning. What kind of advice do you have for people? Because OSCON is sort of like your first day of high school the first time you go. It's overwhelming. What kind of advice do you have for first time attendees?
Well, I think the comparison to, I was thinking of it more as summer camp than as this high school, but maybe that's just because it's in July. But, you know, you first get there, there's a crowd of thousands of people who have interests that are somewhat similar to yours or intersecting yours, we hope. It's not just a matter of like diving into the crowd and meeting everyone, because it doesn't go so easily. If you're starting out with a tutorial day, I feel like there's kind of this gentler on-ramp. There's, you know, you have four extended sessions of deep technical content, which may help melt your brain a little bit, we hope. But it's a little quieter, it's a little calmer. The conversations tend to be more technically focused. As you get into the main day, as you get into keynotes, as you get into the expo hall, it becomes a much more swirling, much more people everywhere, so much stuff happening that it's really hard to absorb, you know, any one piece of it. My usual advice to people is to slow down. If you need to pause and take a session off to clear your head or to have an especially great hallway conversation, that's fine. I never attend conferences. I never have attended conferences by going to every single session, every single track. Well, every single session during a time, going to 18 tracks at a time is one of those really difficult things that requires cloning. This year we are doing something different actually that kind of eases that though. We're recording all of the sessions at OSCON, so there is an all access pass this time. If you want to take home that whole set of stuff, and if it makes it easier for you to go to the conference without feeling guilty that you can't be in four sessions at once, That's definitely an option that should make life easier. The other thing the other thing I'd suggest is when you get there, you know, you're going to meet a few people at the beginning, and you know, sort of grow a set of friends. It's not something you can do. It's not something, you know, you arrive there and you'll instantly know a table of people, but you will meet people at lunch. You will meet people as you go through things. And I just keep finding that the folks I meet at the beginning are frequently the most helpful. We're all in kind of the same place and can learn from each other.
All right. Yeah. One of the problems I frequently have at OSCON, I'm glad to hear that you're recording the talks, because usually if there's one talk during a time that I want to see, there are five, you know. Somehow the scheduling usually works out to where I always have to make a choice between this talk or that talk rather than having the problem of going to all of the talks. So that's really good. How long will it take for the videos to become available? Any idea?
It's usually been like 3 or 4 weeks after a conference. OSCON is gigantic, even compared to our other conferences. But conference video isn't a huge, you know, editing and complication the same way that like live recorded tutorials tend to be more intricate. So I'm guessing it'll be out within a month or so of OSCON finishing.
All right.
Oh, hey, so I had a follow-up to that, actually. One of the things I've noticed is in the shift as open source matures, the type of vendors that we're seeing in the expo hall and probably sponsors for the conference as well have been shifting to more and more platform as a service kind of companies rather than end companies that are providing open source software in particular. And the reason I know this is because every year, of course, I scour the expo halls for more guests for Floss Weekly. And yes. I'm finding it harder and harder to find anybody that really qualifies as open source, isn't just using open source to create a platform. Have you noticed this? And do you think the trend's going to continue?
Yes, I think the trend is pretty firm there. We do our best to include a lot of open source projects. You know, we have a lot of tables for nonprofits. We have a lot of we create spaces for those kinds of conversations. Some of our sponsors, I think it was Bluehost last year, actually brought in small. I think it was actually small websites that were nonprofits that happened to use Bluehost, but were more telling the story of what they did rather than what Bluehost did. Mm. The open source ecosystem has really expanded to include a lot of services that aren't strictly speaking the kind of code sharing that we're used to, that was really at the foundation of the open source movement. So, you know, putting your code up on the cloud requires a lot of pieces that actually they're frequently built on open source, but they aren't always visible. It's sort of a mix. I mean, like on the one hand, I'm really happy to see that lots of people want to provide foundations on which we can deploy all of our great open source code. On the other hand, yeah, I agree. It would be nice if there was more. If there were more sponsors that were themselves really heavily involved in open source projects and bringing their code and others' code to the world.
Yeah, and I've as a disclaimer here, most people probably know this, I've been a vendor at OSCON a number of times in the expo hall, and those booths aren't cheap. And so you really have to have a financial motivation, and that does sort of skew the kind of people that we would see at the expo hall. And I'm really glad that you guys also provide spaces for nonprofits to also have their say in that, because that to me, you know, that reminds me of the original early Pearl conferences and original OSCONs, where 90% of the booths were that, and now it's more like 20%. And I was just noticing the trend, and I appreciate your comment on that.
Yeah, it's something where we really want to strike a balance. We definitely want to make sure the conference, you know, stays with the open source ideal, stays with the community, brings in people that you might not hear from if it was just about the dollars, because there's so much more to this than just the finances of it. I'm hoping that we'll be able to make that, you know, go really well this year through the sessions, through the keynotes, and through, you know, the people that we're bringing in to really tell those stories.
It also, on the other side of that, though, it's really interesting that, I don't know if any of us could have predicted all this, you know, 15 years ago. There's just directions that the open source ecosystem has gone in terms of being able to be empowering and enabling for commercial ventures to happen. And especially, I think I'm still surprised, you know, here I am at this microphone every week talking to these projects, but I'm still surprised at the number of companies that have fully embraced open source as being this potluck of, you know, you can take a bunch of food that you wouldn't have had otherwise, but as long as you bring something back to the table. And I see a lot of these companies doing this and really embracing this in a useful way.
Yeah, it used to be kind of a battle to get them even to think about coming to the potluck. Like, Dish to Pass just wasn't their style. It was, yep. You know, I have a restaurant. Why would I bring a Dish to Pass? The good thing, I mean, we talk sometimes about how open source is one, and I think open source is no longer this strange alien creature that businesses in particular want to avoid. There's still some residue from past battles. There's still a lot of people who have strong opinions about whether you should be using open source at all. I saw some of that with some of the responses to Heartbleed. You know, open source created this gigantic problem, and people seem to forget Apple's go-to failure a few months before, and then we had IE this week. And yeah, so there's still some of that. But at the same time, I'm really heartened to see, like, a few weeks ago, Microsoft was announcing that they were open sourcing some core compiling parts. These are not pieces I ever would have expected Microsoft to open source. I know it's a long ways from open sourcing everything, but it's definitely a major change in the way that they see this. They kind of tested the water with small things. It's not necessarily an easy relationship. I think anyone who's watched Oracle's relationship with open source can tell those stories. But we're getting there. And that by itself is pretty amazing to me.
Yeah, I think Microsoft learned a bit from their fiasco of the open sourcing, quote unquote, of Windows many years ago, where it was really just, you can look at it, but you can't use it and you can't compile it. We just provide the source because we had to check off that box for some government organization somewhere.
Right. It wasn't really, it didn't really resemble open source, except that you could look at it. Open source doesn't live behind glass. That model doesn't work very well. And I mean, one thing, so I just wrote a piece this week called Just Fork It. You can find it on the O'Reilly Programming blog. It's interesting to me how even open source communities have some challenges with the idea of other people, you know, getting into their code and changing things. I mentioned Heartbleed earlier. There's been kind of a cranky fork between the OpenSSL and the LibreSSL people. There's a battle going on the specification side between the W3C and the WhatWG over reuse of specs that are openly licensed. And it's kind of strange to me. Like, on the one hand, we have these licenses that encourage people to go out and fork. And we now have Git and GitHub, which encourage people to fork and pull and you know, build an entire set of social practices around this. But it's still very hard to get even people who are committed to openness to let go of that kind of control of my project. It's so important. I hope at OSCON we can, you know, foster more movement towards openness at every level.
So I kind of call there are two things at play there, though: what the license allows you to do and what the community around a project thinks is acceptable. And those aren't necessarily the same thing. I've made comments before criticizing Oracle, for example, about the way they handle an open source project, and had people come back and say, you know, well, the GPL allows it. The GPL allows clubbing baby seals too, but it doesn't mean that the community has to accept it.
Mean the community has to accept, you know, every fork, every change. But what I'd like to see is a reduction in fury when there's a fork. Just start accepting that this is a normal way of doing business. The GPL is one example. The other one going the other direction is Apache, where, you know, you can do anything with it, including include it in code that isn't open source. And the communities have different opinions on these things that aren't necessarily tied to their licenses. We have gotten used, though, and I kind of think this is a piece that comes from the older ways of developing software, and in particular the older tools. With CVS, you couldn't just, you know, throw open the door. If somebody wanted to clone the entire thing and do something else, they could, but why would you? That would hurt. I hope over time we can find ways for communities to feel a little less threatened by the notion of, okay, somebody over there is doing something different.
But isn't it better, though, to have to try to control these things by social convention rather than by licensing? I mean, I think that, you know, for Apache is a really good example. I'd rather have the companies that might fork and, you know, maintain a proprietary branch of an Apache project be hesitant to do so because of the community reaction rather than the licensing.
What I'm hoping we can reconcile is the community. The communities aren't exactly reflecting the licenses that they're using at this point. I appreciate the desire to control where a project goes. I personally worry a lot about contributing to projects that get used for purposes I find reprehensible. That's really a core issue with open source is freedom zero, as the FSF takes it. At the same time, I think there's a lot that we can gain by actually encouraging people to look at projects as a whole rather than submitting pull requests for fairly tiny pieces. I look at the kinds of changes that the LibreSSL people are making to the open SSL code base, and I think those are things that would not have happened within the existing community, you know, dropping support for large chunks of things. But those are the kinds of conversations we need to have as we develop software moving forward. I also do a lot of work with Erlang lately, and it's now under the MPL. It's been a long conversation figuring out, you know, what the relationship of the company is going to be to the community. And it's still very much an evolving conversation. There are some people who think that Ericsson has entirely too much control. There are some people who think that Ericsson has entirely too little control. I suspect the reality is someplace in the middle, and we'll have an easier time talking about these things if we're a little less concerned about control and a little more concerned about the code itself.
So I've been involved with OSCON on a number of different levels. I've been a speaker. I've been a vendor. I've been covering it for Floss Weekly and trying to find people to interview for Floss Weekly over the years. But what's it like behind the scenes? Are you guys just crazy nutty for like the last 4 months before OSCON, and then you got like 8 months to kick back? Or is it something sort of much more leveled out?
Well, at the end of OSCON last year, basically all of the chairs, and I was kind of a chair in waiting. I was on stage, but I hadn't actually organized the conference. We basically all took long naps that day. It is the conference itself is pretty exhausting. The scheduling, though, there are kind of two big bursts, well, I guess three big bursts of activity. So getting the call for proposals out, kind of deciding what we want the conference to look like really roughly, is not that intensely complicated. It requires conversation, but it's not like reviewing 1,000 proposals. We fortunately have a program committee to help us out with that. That's the huge burst. When the proposals come in, you know, we have about a month to go from giant pile of proposals to neatly organized schedule in a grid. So that's about a month of really intense OSCON focused activity with Sarah Novotny and Matthew and I trying to make a lot of decisions based on feedback from about 80 people on the program committee, which is awesome. Their feedback makes it totally work. So once that's done, then there's a brief quiet period between that and the ramp up for OSCON. We open registration, and then there's a regular set of, you know, we need to be talking about OSCON. We need to be telling open source stories. We need to be reaching out to more people. But that's fairly calm. And then, wow, it's the conference. We're here. there's a setup day. There's, you know, lots of things that need to be tweaked, gotten right. The whole excitement of being on stage when you can't really see the audience through the lights is its own strange, very different from the scheduling conversation kind of work. I was marveling at Fluent just at the amount of work that went into setting up the stages, and the AV for the main stage there was astonishing. I forgot to drop something off, and I had to come back in when they were tearing it down, and I was just kind of looking. These guys are like breaking apart these giant metal constructions that were holding up the lights, and there's so much that goes into the show. I just marvel at it.
And so are you involved with other O'Reilly conferences besides OSCON?
Yeah, I'm the co-chair of the Fluent conference, which is has mostly been our web front end conference. It's kind of web front end with a dose of Node and some Meteor. It's getting a little more full stack over time. I sort of like we all talk about each other's conferences. The conference folks are all in contact with each other. But right now, my primary focus is very definitely OSCON. In a few months, it'll switch over to being Fluent for a little while, and then it, you know, will switch back into being OSCON. So I'm doing two. I'm doing two different ones. We have a few shows like Strata and Velocity where they do two or three of them in different locations with basically the same idea. With OSCON and Fluent, you know, they have an overlap, but they're pretty different shows in pretty different communities.
And I've noticed it seems like, maybe just my impression of this, but it seems like O'Reilly's announcing a new conference about every 6 months. That's for some entirely different topic area. Do those get sourced originally from OSCON, or are they just sort of the brainchild of all the smart people that you have working for O'Reilly?
And a lot of the conversations have actually started at OSCON historically. They aren't all like coming out of OSCON. This was something that succeeded at OSCON, and we need to do a lot more of it. The way that tends to work is, you know, someone inside or outside of O'Reilly has an idea and starts talking with our conferences team. We have at least one more in the works right now. That's another O'Reilly conference. It's not specifically open source focused. But, you know, Velocity has a lot of pieces that we used to have bits of at OSCON, but they can focus on much more strongly. Strata was concocted by Ed Dumble, who at the time was also chair of OSCON and saw a piece of the conversation that definitely seemed worth focusing on. So I'd say OSCON's really been a place where a lot of conferences have been born, or at least, you know, conceived. There's a lot of content at OSCON colliding with other content, and you don't get the same kinds of interactions when you go to a show that just has, you know, one core topic. I love going to shows that are like single track, and I can sit there and really absorb everything the show has to offer. But OSCON has this pretty unique cross-pollination opportunity that I think does give rise to other conferences.
So the conference business is quite a big chunk of what O'Reilly does, at least from the outside perspective of me and being a guy who writes for O'Reilly. Is it a strategic chunk of O'Reilly, or is it just there to help sell more books, or
is it
a money making center itself?
Well, we're in publishing and conferences, which are not famous businesses for making huge sums of money. It's a natural complement. So for a long time, you know, we would have O'Reilly books at O'Reilly conferences. We would have O'Reilly authors who were frequently speakers. There was some back and forth, but we had conferences and books in kind of separate boxes. We thought about them differently. We didn't really connect the people that strongly. I was on the OSCON program committee from the time I started at O'Reilly, kind of by a historical accident. It was nice to still be on the OSCON program committee when I was editing books about Microsoft Excel and Access. It gave me something very different and happy to think about. Mm-hmm. But at this point, we're looking for ways to bring them more closely together. As books have become less paper, more electronic, we're finding ways for that to blend into the electronic side of a live conference talk. We're using some of the same technologies. You'll see this in Paco Nathan's talk at OSCON or Scott Murray's talk at OSCON that we used for books to create electronic versions that include live examples and more interesting pieces than you can typically get onto paper or even into an ebook, which seems a lot like paper under glass frequently. So we're taking those ideas that we're getting from publishing and bringing them to conferences. We're also trying to find ways as we're doing more and more video. You did a video for us a year or so ago. We're definitely going to be doing more and more of that, where we're looking for a lot of content that used to slip between us. We had books and we had conferences, but training was sort of in the middle of that. Trainers do, you know, live presentations, but they also frequently have materials that they leave behind for people to work through and learn from. So at this point, we're trying to really make the two businesses work together much more tightly. And even personally, I'm co-chair of OSCON, I'm co-chair of Fluent, and I'm still actively involved in at least our web publishing program. And I, you know, regularly talk with folks about other OSCON related programming, book projects, video projects. Yeah, it's changing. It's pretty exciting and sometimes complicating.
Cool. And the, just so people don't get disappointed when they submit a call for papers, what's the ratio? What's the ratio of how many submissions you get versus how many slots you actually have, roughly?
For OSCON, it's 4 or 5 to 1, roughly, but it also varies a lot by topic. So if you put in for the basically the web track, it was probably more like an 8 to 1 ratio.
Ugh.
So it's hard, and sorting through this is really painful. We could have put together another conference from the OSCON CFP pretty easily that would have been a great show. Just out of proposals that we didn't take. And I'm sure there were proposals we didn't take that we should have. That's just the nature of trying to put these things together. But yes, it's harder than it seems like it should be. Yes.
And of course your job is really hard. You have to make sure that all the really cool talks are across from each other, right?
Right. Well, we want to make your life as complicated as possible at the conference. There are actually a few things we need to clean up in the current schedule that we found. One thing that helps is that, you know, we get feedback from people who are doing things like using the personal scheduler. And, you know, if we suddenly see something line up where there's one time that is all lit up with people wanting to go to it, we have a chance to change it. We also need to make sure we don't do things like put Damian Conway into a small room that creates kind of a crowd scene trying to get in.
I got to challenge that, because every time you put Damian Conway anywhere, you put him across from me.
Oh, well, then we clearly need to fix that too. next to his small room.
Yeah, Damian and I have been at OSCON now for like 7 or 8 years in a row as speakers, and we've always been exactly across from each other. It's been really annoying.
I'll check the schedule and try to make sure that doesn't happen again this year. It would be good for you to at least be able to see each other's sessions.
It can't happen this year because he didn't put a talk in. So I actually get to go see Damian. Yeah, that'll be nice.
Yes.
Sorry,
well,
I
didn't
get there. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, the other thing that's kind of funny, I mean, like when I was going through the schedule, I have this kind of split interest in a few different areas. So I mean, like the web area is totally my focus, but I'm also spending a lot of time with Erlang and Elixir, and I'd like to go see those talks. And of course, you know, we schedule web talks opposite them that I'd also like to go see. So that's, even the chairs have a hard time sometimes with too many interests and too wide a schedule.
So I'm kind of curious, you mentioned, you know, you have a 4 to 1, 5 to 1, 8 to 1 ratio for some of these. You're doing multiple stratas, you're doing multiple other conferences. You've got the Linux Foundation folks doing, you know, LinuxCon and Cloud Open US and EU. Is it maybe time for there to be an OSCON Europe or an OSCON winter show that, you know, would, because I mean, also things move really fast. And I've found one of the problems I frequently have with submitting proposals to OSCON is I'm working on things that may not be public yet that I would like to propose. By the time OSCON happens, they will be, but you know, the CFP is already done at that point.
Yes. One of the big headaches with all of these is that the conference, because we need to, you know, open registration, we need to have most of the schedule assembled well before the conference actually happens. So there's a lot of material that, you know, 3 weeks before the conference, I'm going, I really wish I could include that somehow. And, you know, a lot of it's the situation you were describing where you're working on something, but it's not yet public, so you can't put it into a CFP where lots of other people will see it. That's something we'd like to work on by, well, I've been talking about doing OSCON year-round, which is not that we're going to occupy the Oregon Convention Center all year. That would get really complicated and really expensive. But that we do more things with OSCON in the off-season. Some of that's going to be online. Some of that's going to be sort of more publishing-like things, maybe some video. I would definitely love to see us expand. Europe, we actually did for a couple of years, like 2005, 2006, and I'd love to see us get back there. Winter is an intriguing idea. It's sort of not as conference season as summer seems to be. I have this weird relationship with Portland where I think I've maybe seen it rain once there because I've always been there in late June or in July. So, the summer thing for OSCON has really been pretty. I'd love to have a CFP that stayed open, because right now we, you know, put up the CFP, then we close the doors, and the rest of the year we're not really listening for proposals the way we should be. Mm-hmm. So as we get into this more year-round mode, and especially if we expand to other places, I would love to keep the doors open for, you know, more ideas whenever they happen to come in. And there may be things we can do, you know, with your situation with you can't put in the proposal until it's too late because of nature of public and private. We might, you know, be able to do more with late breaking. Some shows have an explicit late breaking space. We haven't really done that, but maybe we should.
Would the OSCON committee or you personally, I mean, how would you feel about someone approaching you outside the CFP saying, you know, look, I don't want to dump this in the call for papers, but this is, you know, we know we're going to have something happening. This is the general flavor. How could we, you know, save a spot for that? Is that something that would be annoying to you, or would that be okay with the chairs that are going through these things?
If we suddenly got 1,100 of those, yes, it would be annoying, but that's not likely to happen. You can definitely contact the chairs. You know, we do actually have some of these conversations. I think it's probably, you know, it's probably like 5 to 10 of them a year. And some of them make it in, some of them don't. It's still, you know, it's just difficult to schedule, but it's definitely an option for people who need to go a different route than, hey, look at my proposal, all 80 people, I'm not sure who you are.
So over the years, I've noticed that OSCON seems to be getting bigger, but at some point there's going to be like, is the attendance limited at all? Or whoever just wants to go can go?
Well, we haven't hit the limit yet. The Oregon Convention Center is pretty vast. There is, right now we're using kind of the bigger half of the Oregon Convention Center. If we need to, and I would love to need to, it would be great to grow beyond that. But we still have space. And the main constraint, like physically, is the keynote space. Not everyone comes to keynotes, but you want to be able to accommodate everybody. So mm-hmm. That's sort of where you tend to hit the natural limit. I think as far as the session rooms, as far as, you know, being able to have the space for a comfortable hallway track, I think we're still in pretty good shape. We're definitely trying to grow it. I mean, there are just more and more places where open source is mattering. I'm finding them like weekly. We would love to stretch to cover more of that and to capture more people's interest. So yes, we're definitely trying to grow.
Cool. We're almost out of time. Is there anything I haven't asked you yet about OSCON that you want to make sure our audience is aware of?
I think we've actually done a pretty thorough job. I guess just to remind people, because I didn't know it last year, you'll get a train ticket for the Portland trains when you come to OSCON. So you'll have the ability to explore Portland and all of its restaurants and Powell's bookstore and all that other great stuff, you know, easily. Last year I bought one at the airport and got there and realized they had one for me. So, you know, something else exciting is just Portland itself is awesome, and we do what we can to get people to explore the city.
Yeah, and people that have been to OSCON at Portland before also need to realize that since between last year and this year, they've gotten rid of Fairless Square. So basically, you always pay when you get on a train now.
That's why we're doing the train ticket thing. So it's a week's pass. So you're covered for that.
Very
once,
cool.
Once you've registered.
Yeah. Let's see. I'm trying to think of anything else I want to ask about that. OSCON, I got one more question. It might be a bit controversial, so if you decline answering, it's fine. But I've heard from a lot of my friends that OSCON is not cheap, and therefore it's less likely that they're going to attend unless they have some sort of corporate sponsorship for it. What would you say to those kind of people complaining?
I understand the problem a little too well. The big thing that I've seen in the last few years, and I first saw this. I was actually mostly focused on it on the JavaScript side, though it's certainly been there on the open source side, is there are a lot of great things you can do with a community conference that are much cheaper, that are much lower impact on attendees' wallets than you can do when you're in a convention center space, when you're, you know, setting up all of this crazy lighting and AV and feeding people and all of that. We're trying our best to keep things at a reasonable balance where people can still attend. But there's sort of this scaling boundary where once you cross over from like using a space that's already basically set up to using a space that needs to be configured, needs to carry, you know, Wi-Fi for thousands of people, the economics change fairly dramatically. The way that we've mostly, you know, helped people into the show is through being speakers. Obviously you get free admission and we can talk about other possibilities. It's not a great answer because especially for newcomers, it can be hard to justify. I know a lot of people out there seem to get one conference a year or no conferences a year. The other piece that we're doing, I mean, we've live streamed the keynotes for a long time. So it's possible for people to experience OSCON without actually coming, at least experience some parts of it. The video package is also another way to experience it for a lot less money, a lot less travel, certainly. But at the same time, you know, I know that's not, you're not going to get the hallway track from that. You might get some stuff from Twitter, which is another exciting back channel, but doesn't really compare to the joy of being there. I wish I had ways to make a lot of these costs disappear. Right now it's a tough spot.
I understand. I mean, it's you get a lot of value for the money, but for some people that money is a barrier there. Although I can't speak from experience because I haven't paid for a conference in like 20 years. So,
but it's a reasonable concern.
Yeah, I hear it. Definitely. Well, and thank you for your frank answer about that too. I really appreciate that. I have two questions I have to ask every guest. If you've listened to the show before, you know what they are. What's your favorite text editor?
My favorite text editor these days is TextMate.
Okay.
But I bounce between different systems and different, yeah. I mean, I'm one of those terrible people who still uses Nano or Pico when I have the chance. So, for sort of real text editing, it's TextMate, and every now and then I go back to BBEdit. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's a ways back. There's a flashback there. And your favorite scripting language or programming language, I guess, would be something in that category?
I'm having a hard time with that lately. Historically, I've really spent a lot of time in JavaScript, but lately I've been kind of entranced by the siren song of functional programming. So, you know, I was doing Erlang. I'm really loving Elixir right now. I think at the moment I've got to say Elixir, though. Yeah, it's a hard call.
Elixir, I'm not familiar with that. Is it something on Erlang?
So Elixir's Hossein Alim, who did a lot of work in Ruby and with Rails, has been developing a new language that runs on the Erlang virtual machine. It has all of its concurrency and general functional programming magic, but the syntax is set up to enable, you know, Ruby-style metaprogramming and a lot more. It doesn't look like Prolog. I think that's kind of a feature that people really like. I liked Erlang being so different from JavaScript that I never had to worry about, you know, confusing which language I was in. Elixir looks more conventional to a lot of programmers. And it's at 0.13. It's supposed to be at 1.0 sometime this summer. If you're looking for a new language to explore, I would totally recommend just look up Elixir.
Cool. I'll have to get them on the show. It sounds like a great topic.
It is. It's all open source, and it's a really open community, too.
Well, thank you, Simon, for coming on the show and talking about OSCON, a subject near and dear to my heart, and appreciate the other parts of the conversation as well.
Great. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Great. That was Simon St. Laurent representing OSCON. What did you think, Joe?
It's good. I'm really looking forward to OSCON this year. We're doing a lot of planning for what we're going to be doing there. And I do have to counter what you were saying earlier about companies not having companies on the floor that are all open source.
Counter it how?
I'll be at the Red Hat booth.
Oh. Oh, you're saying, yes, there are companies that are open source. I understand that. But it seems like a lot of them are. A lot of them are PaaS, and a lot of them are, you know, platform as a service sort of stuff. So, yeah.
But that's, we have that. That's open too.
Yes. It's true. Okay. Yeah. You got it. It's fine. I'm noticing though, like I said, I'm noticing going around the expo hall trying to find now. Well, the trouble is I have to find open source projects that I have not already done on Floss Weekly. That's the other thing that discounts about half the floor now is that, you know, this is almost show 300, and we've done, you know, a whole bunch of those subjects already. So I have to find somebody I haven't done yet already for Floss, and also that is open source in the sense that we can actually have something we can do.
That constraint does it make it slightly trickier? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like we had a whole series of shows that Red Hat provided us with guests for, so that was a lot of fun there, almost like Red Hat Quarter, I think it was. We had like 15 different projects on there. Anyway, so we digress. We do have shows. We actually have shows coming up. We have shows coming up. Next week, we have JITMEET, which is the Jitsi Video Bridge. Think of it as Jitsi, which is an open source video audio bridge for the equivalent of Google Hangouts, but all open source from top to bottom. We may even actually do a live demo of that during next week's taping. We'll see if we can get everything to work for that. Immediately following that, we've got the Digital Public Library of America, which aims to index the metadata of all the wonderful media that's out there. So they have all sorts of things that you can say, look for pictures of Portland, Oregon, and it'll show you all the different places those might be out there in the world. Tonika, which is a platform for social networks. So think of it as the next big, you know, Facebook, but all open source, something like that. I'm still scheduling Q2. I've got a bunch of emails I sent out last night, still waiting for the responses on those. We've got a few new people that have contacted me about being on the show, so we're just waiting for them to decide on dates. If you go to twit.tv/floss, that is the homepage for this show. And from there, you'll see the link to the big Google spreadsheet that has all the information on it about who we are talking to. If there's somebody that is not on that list that you would like to have them be on, to be on one of our shows, just have the project leader email me, merlin@stonehenge.com, and I will try to get them on the list as quickly as possible. In fact, since we've got some openings coming up very soon, they could be on as quickly as like 3 weeks from now, so that'll be really cool. We do have a live chat room. Took a couple questions from there today. That's at live.twit.tv. Normally at 8:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays. Again, this is a very special show because we're taping Thursday this time, but if you go to the spreadsheet, you can actually see when our upcoming shows are going to be. You can follow us on Floss Weekly on Google Plus. I announce when shows are happening and when changes happen, like the one that moved it from yesterday to today. That gets cross-posted automatically to Floss Weekly on Twitter. Identica's gone. We also have, you can follow me at Merlin on Twitter, but more likely you're going to find a lot more of my stuff on Google Plus at Randall L. Schwartz. And that's all I want to plug for this week. Joe, you want to plug something?
Yeah. So since the last time we were on Summit, we announced Project Atomic. That would be one of those things, by the way, we couldn't get into the CFP for OSCON. So Project Atomic is basically a set of tools to create what we call an atomic host for running Docker containers. So if you just go to projectatomic.io, you'll learn all about that. And if you have any questions about that or any questions that people want to shoot to me, just find me on Twitter, and I'm just at JZB. So I'm real easy to look up there.
Yeah, one of those convenient tree character handles. I didn't get quite in that early, so yeah. But I got Merlin. That was good. I got my normal internet handle, so it was nice. And I think that means we're just about done. So we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly. Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Joe... I can't say Brockmeyer now. Oh, God. Hi, this is Randall giggling. God. I'm in giggle phase now. This is not going to work. Hold on. Oh, now I spilled. Great. Good thing it's not where you can see. Oh, that's hot. Okay. Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Joe Brockmeyer. This week, Joe Brockmeyer. Practice.
Do you know we're collecting all of these?
I know. This is all going to be in the outtake reel, I can tell. Hi, this is Randall Schwartz. This week... This week in Floss. It's coming on soon. Just stay tuned. Hi, this is...
I think we need another tugboat.
A rooster. Let's put a rooster buzzing.